Ken Munshine, you last year on the March for the Food Bank walked in medieval armor and destroyed the upper part of your foot.
This is true. There was blood, there was sweat, there was tears, but mainly it was blood.
And you're going to march for the food bank again with us next week, but hopefully in armor or something that will be less painful.
In boots, hopefully.
Oh, yeah.
Not in sneakers, so the upper part of my armor doesn't dig into my shin, leaving a trail of blood from Northampton to Greenfield.
But you are an expert in all things medieval and armor and warfare in the medieval times, and you have a new book out called Game of Thrones and the Medieval Art of War. You are a historical fencing teacher at Pioneer Valley Fencing in East Hampton. You're a history professor at Anna Maria College in Worcester, and people who may not have previously been into anything that has to do with medieval culture or times are now kind of swept up into that milieu because of the Song of Ice and Fire books and Game of Thrones, especially the television show on HBO. Now, full disclosure, I have read all of the available Song of Ice and Fire books and have never watched one episode of Game of Thrones, but I hear it's really good. I was going to wait till all the books are out, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen before the series ends. Your book is interesting in that you run parallel timelines between actual medieval history and the imagined medieval-ish history of Game of Thrones. So how accurate is what is happening in warfare, in armor, in the world that George R.R. Martin has created?
Well, he's more or less accurate, actually. It's rather surprising. George R.R. Martin is a huge medieval history buff, and he's pretty knowledgeable about these things. Of course, there's places where he slips up, but rather than condemning him for that or saying, oh, he's getting this all wrong, I thought, well, wouldn't it be a more fun game to sort of look at the books and justify what he's done and say, given my knowledge of medieval history, can I cover for Martin's slip-ups?
Uh-huh.
So that's really was the aim of this book. For instance, the prices of things are all over the place, so can I explain that in terms of the economics of a world that has 10-year-long winters? That was a lot of fun.
George R.R. Martin will borrow from some storylines from actual medieval history, and they work their way into his world of Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, which if you just watch the TV show, that's actually what the series is called. Game of Thrones is just the first book.
Yeah, so he borrows a bunch of things and a bunch of ideas. The Red Wedding, for instance, had its counterpart in a dinner party that happened in Scotland, or also the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre actually started where they massacred the guests at a wedding. So a lot of the stuff that happens has counterparts in real history. In fact, a lot of the history, and if you read the last chapter, is perhaps even more horrific than the stuff that George R. R. Martin dreams up.
Who could have thought that it could have been more horrific than that?
But of course, if you're thinking tactically, that's probably the best time to try and kill somebody. The guest right that he talks about has more counterparts in ancient Greece, perhaps, than in medieval Europe. But certainly, if you're enjoying someone's hospitality, it's assumed that they're not going to try and kill you.
Yeah, let's hope. Thanksgiving's coming right up.
Monty, what are you doing with that dagger? I thought I had guest right in the studio, man.
I'm speaking with Ken Munshine, who is an author of the new book, Game of Thrones, The Medieval Art of War, a historical fencing professor, a history professor, a doctorate in medieval history, and looking at George R.R. Martin's world through the lens of actual history. One of the things that you talk about in the introduction to the book that I think is fascinating is your attempt to incorporate different people than are usually portrayed in the worlds of fantasy in medieval history and in the actual some aspects of medieval history. You're trying to make this a broader table and welcoming more people into this conversation.
If you think about medieval history and fantasy literature, the world portrayed, it tends to be one where there aren't a lot of people of color.
Or that there's, you know, maybe people think it's an analogy, it's a race. Like some people accuse J.R.R. Tolkien of being a racist or an anti-Semite in regards to his world in Lord of the Rings.
If you even think about Dungeons and Dragons, and of course, we've all played D&D, even though we won't admit it.
Hello, nerds.
But this idea of races, Gary Gygax comes up with these ideas of races and different races of people, and that there are evil races, and there are kind of really troubling implications for this. You go from that, you go to things like Frank Frazetta, where paintings, and Conan the Barbarian, where, you know, it really is a sort of white male dream of power. And that's something that not just fantasy literature has to contend with, but history does, especially since in the current political climate, that there are a lot of people on the alt-right who are seizing on medieval imagery, and by which I mean also their idea of medieval imagery, what they think of as medieval, to justify what they want politically. They seize on the Knights Templar as justification for anti-Islamicism. They seize upon Norse runes as an imaginary Scandinavia, as a pure white place, when in fact they had a lot of contact with the Muslim world and a lot of trade went on. In many ways, this really is a myth. One purpose in writing this book is that I wanted to give a counter myth and counter narrative. So I have a chapter on diversity in the Middle Ages because, yeah, you probably wouldn't find many people of African descent in, say, 12th century Lincolnshire in the middle of England, but certainly in Spain, in the Mediterranean, on the borders, where the really interesting things happen. If you think of it, you know, England, France, there are really backwaters in the medieval world, but there was a lot of cross-cultural contact. In the same way, I give a typology of women and women in warfare, and in a world such as the Middle Ages, where political power was associated with being part of the military class, what was women's place in this? I thought that was something that was necessary to deal with as well, and to draw people in through these really popular books. And George R. R. Martin does deal with a lot of these issues in his books, but also to use that as introduction to get people reading about real medieval history and how it's really different from some of these fantasies of what medieval history was like.
Ken Munshine's book, Game of Thrones and the Medieval Art of War, is out now. You talk about knighthood in this book and how in the world of Game of Thrones, there's maybe none, but maybe one true knight. What makes a true knight? Were there ever historically real true knights? And why does the one character from Game of Thrones, you think, rise above the other folks who could be considered knights in the book?
Even Barristan Selmy.
Yes.
Who, spoiler alert, unfortunately buys it in a rather inglorious way on the show. Barristan himself, I think, by the fact that he is an older man, shows this idea of knighthood as a relic. Were there ever true knights? Well, that's a big debate even amongst historians. Because who are knights? Knights were soldiers. The Hound says knights are for killing in the books, and he's right. Knights were warriors, and war is necessarily brutal. Now, there was this common understanding amongst knights within people of their own social class. Hey, you capture me, then I'll pay ransom, and maybe next year I'll capture you, and I'll let you ransom yourself. But at the same time, towards people who are not in their social class, they can be absolutely brutal. The question is if chivalry was more observed in the breach than in the observance is really one that has been debated for years and years. And Martin shows that in the book, that there's a great deal of hypocrisy. In that, I think his works are deeply realistic.
You think the real medieval world was more bloody and brutal than the world that George R. R. Martin created in Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones?
I may be kind of cynical about this, but I think people are pretty much the same as they've always been, and that people always seek their self-interests, and that in many cases, real politic won out over ideals, which isn't to say that there weren't ideals. Ideals are there to hold us to our best behavior. But if you look at the world today, we certainly have a whole lot of ideals, but they are more often honored in the breach than the observance. Louis C.K. pops to mind, for instance.
There may be one chivalrous knight among us, and that is Ken Munshine. This is, I believe, the third or fourth time that you've done the March for the Food Bank?
Third time. Second time in armor, I think.
And is going to march from Northampton to Greenfield in full armor, but better protected than last year so that there will be no blood, we hope.
Hopefully.
That stuff is still heavy. How heavy is it?
Oh, about 60 pounds or so, but it's not so bad because it's strapped down all over my body.
Ken is raising money for the food bank independently through the First Giving page. You can find a link on Ken's Facebook. It's Ken Munshine. And or go to WRSI.com and you'll be able to see the First Giving for all the folks that are part of the March for the Food Bank. Thank you again for writing the book, teaching us about medieval history and how it collaborates with George R. R. Martin's world, and for marching for the food bank once again.
Thank you, Monty.